Greetings, I'm your host Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. So happy to have you guys live with us here this evening, and of course happy to be with the people that will be watching us later, and of course listening to us later on the audio only podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit that like button, hit subscribe, but don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. We're constantly adding new shows and doing cross streams with other channels. And just so you know, this show is live. We just started on time. All the black people here early. We got here on time. So congratulations for that. I'm probably jinxing everything. I'm sure someone's going to have some tech issues. Jesus. That being said, the show. This is live and on time. Earlier this week, we had a return of longtime TIR family member Dan Mello, as well as a new face to many of you that watch the show, a journalist out of Texas, John Salazar. And we discussed the atrocities still happening at the U.S.-Mexican border. John has done some real good work telling the truth about what's going on at the border and also laying out what Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been doing. Then yesterday, we aired a pre-recorded conversation with me, Gene Bajlan, and Derek Varn talking about right populism with editor of Compact Magazine, Sohrab Armani. Probably saying the name wrong, and I apologize. A very interesting discussion when you guys get done here. Those episodes are up. Please go check them out. Also, we've got clips up. Definitely have a really good clip of our conversation with Nicholas Kiersey about Ireland. Took a segment of it. Ireland during and after the 2008 crash. As always, thank you to the subscribers, YouTube and Twitch, and the audio-only podcast formats as well. Of course, thanks to the patrons. Collectively, you are the fuel and the engine that keeps TIR moving along. So if you're enjoying what we do here and want access to the post-show champagne room, there's only one way: become a patron. For as little as $2 a month, $30 for the year, you can have access to the champagne room past and present. Be part of the virtual live audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour, and join us for movie nights, which we're having tomorrow. I believe we're watching They Live. I love that movie. I haven't seen the movie actually in years, so it'll be my first time seeing it. Jesus, probably in two decades at least. So if you want to be a part of movie night and have be fun, be part of the watch party, there's only one way: become a patron. Now that we have that out of the way, let's bring in the TIR crew. He is the man in Miami, weighing in at a very svelte 215 pounds. What fraternity do you belong to, Pascal? The Pascal Robert.
He's great.
Are you one of these guys? What is this? Is that you?
Alpha Phi Alpha.
Is this you?
Yes.
Did you see the clip I sent you of the judge?
I saw the clip.
There's an episode of one of those judge shows, and one of the gentlemen on the show, his girlfriend or somebody was...
Girlfriend's suing him.
You're suing him, yeah. And she's mentioned he was in a fraternity, and the judge goes, "Oh, what fraternity?" And he says Alpha, and the judge just goes like this, and the dude...
it's not a good look to the day. People think it makes it work. It's that easy. Oh, that's how it works for you fraternity guys. You just contort the wheels of justice with hand signs like gangs.
Aha! I fell out when I saw that, because I was like, this is how Pascal won all his cases in court. Hello, Your Honor.
Not in Miami.
There's like two black judges.
Most of the judges are going to synagogue on Saturday.
So it looks like you pledged the wrong fraternity.
Yeah. Ah, brother. It's not working in Miami.
Speaking of sororities, she is a... What sorority would Toussaint be part of?
I don't know, man. Toussaint, I could see her being like a rabid antagonist to fraternity. I could see her wanting to like Mau Mau all black Greek life.
Is she like the girlfriend in school days?
Which one?
The dark skin one. Yeah, yeah.
Who at the end ends up wanting to pledge with antagonizing sorority.
Oh my goodness. Let's find out. Everyone's favorite faceless sorority woman, Kim Toussaint.
Hello, hello. The calls are coming from inside the house, finally.
You were locked out of your house today.
I was.
Which is odd because you had your keys.
Yeah. It was very, very strange.
How were you locked out?
The keys just wouldn't work.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's some New York shit.
They didn't change the locks on you?
That was so concerning.
That's some eviction shit.
I was like, I paid everything and this is the right apartment. What happened?
You thought she was having a crack illusion?
Mm-hmm. I was on the wrong floor.
But you're in the house now.
Mm-hmm.
You sure?
I am not wearing pants.
Oh, that means she's
wait,
in the
TMI,
house.
TMI, man.
Donald ducking it. Donald ducking it.
All the time, M. Toussaint.
Way TMI, Toussaint.
Well, let's...
You can't be black and Greek at the same time. Just
wow.
I told you. She would be one of those sisters on campus mow-mowing the black fraternities and sororities. She was like, traitors to your race.
Because you're a wannabe.
You already have a sibling, Pascal. You don't need a bunch of dudes to pretend to be your siblings.
Well, listen. One of the things that I enjoyed about having big brothers is that I was the oldest, and I always missed having a big brother. So,
you sure you didn't enjoy the spankings?
No, I didn't enjoy that.
A little paddle time.
I'm trying to be serious here.
And moving on.
As we have witnessed with the threat of the UPS strike, Starbucks, Amazon warehouses, Uber and Lyft, and the gig work services, and of course, Hollywood, labor has come to dominate political discussions. With this rise in worker power, we've seen a conservative usurpation of the leftist rhetoric that we usually associate with the proletarian struggle against capitalist control of the means of production. Trump rode to the White House on a bed of what many refer to as right-wing populism, promising to bring back deindustrialized manufacturing centers, break with China. But his regime made tax cuts for the wealthy its top priority, but incentivized shipping jobs overseas. With Trump in legal hot water, Ron DeSantis is trying to implement some of the right-wing labor-friendly populism into his culture war-heavy campaign rhetoric. From his recent article in Jacobin, our guest today, Paul Prescott, writes, DeSantis decries corporate bailouts, describing this as a form of venture socialism in which gains are privatized and losses are borne by taxpayers. This framing is ambiguous. On the one hand, DeSantis is a sworn opponent of socialism and is likely using the term as a pejorative. On the other hand, the left, too, has used a version of this framing. Martin Luther King Jr. said that the United States has socialism for the rich and rugged free enterprise capitalism for the poor, a quote Bernie Sanders is known to echo. In his speech announcing the plan, DeSantis directly referenced left-wing version, saying, no more socialism for the wealthy and rugged individualism for small businesses, workers, etc. But despite some radical sounding rhetoric, as one reads deeper, his framing of economic issues departs from the left's in a number of sufficient ways. Instead of putting inflation in the context of corporate price gouging, DeSantis blames COVID lockdowns, reckless borrowing, printing and spending. Surely the printing and spending that draws his ire is generous COVID relief packages passed by Congress in response to the pandemic. These programs, such as the child tax credit, were a rare example of the expanded U.S. welfare state and mostly benefited working class families. It appears that DeSantis's biggest problem with the segments of the corporate class is where they fall on the culture war spectrum. DeSantis's plan also places blame for our economic troubles on foreign actors like communist China and immigrants instead of the domestic corporate elite. when he does focus anger in the U.S. ruling class, it's not because of union busting, privatization, usury, wage theft, or any of the many practices that affect working people's daily lives. Instead, once you get past the introduction's rhetorical gloss and dive into the plan itself, it appears that DeSantis's biggest problem with segments of the corporate class is where they fall on the culture war spectrum. Thus, he declares economic independence from a class of progressive corporations looking out for every interest except for that of the American people. The fact that Amazon donated money to Black Lives Matter is apparently far worse than the company's practice of overworking its employees and driving down their wages. That is from Paul Prescott's latest piece in Jacobin, Pro-Worker Republicans Aren't Serious. Please welcome, coming live from West Philadelphia, born and raised, Paul Prescott.
Half my article.
Are you actually in West Philadelphia?
I mean, that's where I live. I'm not born and raised in West Philadelphia, but that's where I live.
Oh, okay. I made that up. I have no idea that you're in West Philadelphia.
Yeah, I've lived here since 2015.
Oh, okay.
I love West. Really? It's like
that's why Jason is trying to start this Umar Johnson thing. I'm actually putting my life in danger, but we're not going to.
Is West Philadelphia still like a middle class, working class Black neighborhood?
Parts of it. Yeah, a large part of it.
I don't know what part.
You are in Umar Johnson territory.
Is he really in West Philly? Is he really?
Yeah, I don't see him anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. He's not. Let's be honest. He's not.
Philly is an interesting town, man.
I mean, it's the greatest city in the world.
Wow.
Okay.
Where were you before? This is coming from 2015? Like, you were in the Barbados before?
No. Well, I've lived in Philly since 2009. I was in North Philly before West Philly.
I mean, he says water.
Where were you raised? Where did you grow up?
In an area called Norristown. Montgomery County, like 40 minutes outside Philadelphia.
Well, you're from the Hicks.
Right.
Paul grew up in the house. Summer,
you said then, Paul grew up in the house. Opposed to the streets?
Yep.
You guys are bullies.
The streets did not raise Paul.
You guys, New Yorkers are bullies.
What? The streets didn't raise him.
Look, the streets didn't raise you and Pascal.
They didn't. I'm just saying.
Mama dropped me off at school, ass Negroes. Let's get to the questions. Paul, is it safe to assume that DeSantis is trying to fill a void that might be left by Trump if he is indeed convicted and sent to prison with his friend of the working man, Blabber?
Well, kind of. I mean, I think you see this kind of rhetoric is actually being echoed across the Republican Party in different ways, and different candidates, some are better at it than others. I mean, I think Trump was the best at kind of virtue signaling, you could say, towards the working class and being able to talk in that way and get support. Now, I mean, I think it's worth stating both in 2016 and 2020, I think the working class part of Trump's coalition was always overstated. I mean, you still had, I think, it was still ultimately a majority middle class, upper middle class people voting for Trump, which is always good to keep in mind. But it is true, you know, he had significant working class support. There were a number of labor unions where, even though the leadership endorsed the Democratic candidate, a majority of the actual members voted for Trump. So he was the best at it. And I think since then, you've seen a lot of Republicans try to signal in this way. I mean, there's DeSantis. I mean, J.D. Vance has been more from Ohio. He's been more consistent in trying to do this. Marco Rubio has made, you know, overtures in this way. And I think this is part, and I think what's more important here, I mean, DeSantis, it seems pretty clear, his campaign's kind of tanking. All indications are it's going to be Trump, at least in the winning the primary. Who knows what's going to happen with all the legal issues. But what's more important here is, besides DeSantis, whatever happens with his campaign, is there is a real shift happening in the Republican Party, not towards doing anything poor working people, but how they talk about it. And there is actual thought behind this. So I referenced in the article a relatively new think tank called American Compass that is attempting. Now, ironically, the guy who runs it, Orrin Cass, was Mitt Romney's campaign manager. You know, that real genuine working class hero, Mitt Romney. But, you know, having said that, I think this group, American Compass, like, I don't think they are a set of people that should be easily dismissed. I mean, they are thinking seriously about this, and they are, I think, thinking intelligently about it, even though I don't agree with them, and I don't think they really have real solutions. But I think it's something we should pay attention to, how they're trying to put together some kind of policy framework that somehow blends Republicanism with something kind of pro-worker. So it is, it's backed up by, I think, a real school of thought that's developing on the right wing right now, and different candidates are trying to adopt it, some more successful than others.
Pascal, I know you had some questions on this.
I have several, but I just, something just came into my mind that I'd really like to ask you. Do you think this is a product of the Republicans calculating that since the Democrats have effectively neutralized the Sanders coterie of the Democratic Party, that their left flank of labor support is weak, and they can use fake populist rhetoric to neutralize the neoliberal NAFTA GATT Democrats, who, by the way, those people who suffered from those things still remember them,
right?
And cover up that slack. You think that they are being that strategic?
I think in a way, because, and I think it's maybe less so to do with how the Democrats neutralize the left, but just the result of what the Democrats have done to working people through things like you just mentioned, NAFTA, abandoning unions, although sure, they're better for unions than Republicans, but still abandoning unions. And they've definitely seen that divide. Trump exploited and exposed this divide. And, you know, we can sit here and say and acknowledge that, of course, Trump was always full of shit about this, what he was going to do for working people, and he didn't do anything when he was in office. But the unfortunate reality is all it takes is for them to signal it better than a Democrat, and that might help them win an election. I mean, I think in 2016 versus Hillary, that's a perfect example. I mean, you had two candidates up there. One of them actually spoke about working class issues and talked about jobs leaving the industrial heartland and spoke to that grievance, and one of them didn't. And it kind of doesn't matter that both of them were full of shit. The person who at least spoke to the grievances was able to win and garner support. And it's kind of like, why not at that point? At least one of you is speaking to my issues. So Trump clearly exposed that, and the Democrats are going to be exposed on that as long as they're not instituting pro-working class policies. It might be kind of interesting what's going to happen in this next race where, and to be clear, I'm not giving some sort of like huge praise of Biden, but in some of the things he's done in infrastructure bills and things like that, there actually happened a number of pro-union measures. He actually recently did something that's actually kind of important around the updating the Davis-Bacon Act, which requires prevailing wage on federal construction projects. It's a very important bill that building trades unions take seriously, and the Biden administration just updated it and made it better. So it'd be kind of interesting if any of that actually works at the level of working class support. And to be clear, I'm not talking about whether official unions endorse them or not. I mean, most official unions, you know, the leadership endorsed Clinton and Biden, and they probably will again, but it's more a matter of like average working class people and union members, are they going to vote for him? But I do think this is part of a strategy. I mean, they saw it worked with Trump to signal to these issues, and there's an opening here. And we actually do have the data showing that working people, broadly defined, and especially people without college degrees, are more and more drifting to the Republican Party if they're not just dropping out of politics altogether. So there is something there they can grab onto.
Well, you know, what's fascinating, though, is that, you know, you're talking about Biden. It's some of his pro-labor policies, I think one of the problems Biden has is that he's still stuck with that move that gutted the railroad workers that, you know, Ocasio-Cortez supported as well. Like, that's still resonating amongst union members that this guy put a shiv in, you know, in working class folk in that way. I mean, I hear my mom is a former 1199 mm-hmm. union member, and she talks about that.
I'll say anecdotally, you know, I now work with Teamsters for a Democratic Union. I was working on the UPS contract campaign the last year, and this was something we heard from members all over. They were really worried. Mm-hmm. Is Biden going to do what he did to the rail? Now, I mean, really? We know that he couldn't have in the same way because the Railway Labor Act covers rail and air workers, and there's a special set of laws that allows him to do that. So he's not able to do the same thing with UPS or regular private sector contracts. But again, most people are not going to be parsing labor law. You know, all they saw is what happened. So it was a big worry, and that was something we had to kind of inoculate people to make them know that regardless of what Biden thinks of all anything that goes down, he's not able to do that in the same way. But you're right, it's very – moves like that are very damaging, and they allow cynical actors such as Trump to posture, you know. Now, on the flip side, I mean, I touched on this in the article, is that, you know, in reality, and there's all these examples coming up where Republicans can demonstrate their support for labor, and they're always nowhere to be found. So, I mean, UPS is a great example. You know, I mean, there were a lot of local rallies and stuff that, you know, it was always only Democrats showing up to. But, you know, Bernie Sanders circulated a letter in the Senate saying, you know, the government will not intervene this time. Not a single Republican signed it. We have the United Auto Workers contracts coming up at Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, which is the new name for Chrysler. Sherrod Brown has actually been doing a lot of good work supporting them. You're not seeing any Republicans. So, you know, every time these things actually come up, they're nowhere to be found. But again, it doesn't necessarily always matter for elections. They can win elections just by
Sherrod Brown's out of Ohio, correct?
Right. And he's Democrat. Yeah.
And Ohio has a lot to gain by, you know, not losing their manufacturing, the little manufacturing sector that they have. The right. Rust Belt is pretty dried up when it comes to manufacturing in general. With this negotiation coming up, which is going to be pretty big as well, do you think the Republicans pivot back to this kind of pro-labor language, or do you think they kind of just stay silent?
I think they're going to stay silent. I mean, they love to signal pro-labor in a way that they can comfortably control the narrative. And I touch on in the article, you know, they always manage to focus on the issue that is auxiliary to the main issue. So instead of a really straightforward, I support unions and like, I'm going to support a union in this contract fight for higher wages, they always manage to come up with something else. Like, oh no, I'm really just against Amazon saying they like Black Lives Matter. Or, you know, Marco Rubio introduced this bill about instead of a union, why don't we give workers a seat on a board to run the company, but in the fine print, they don't have any voting power. They can just make suggestions. So, and you know, whenever it comes to these contract fights, all of a sudden it's just like silence. Now, I mean, I think you'll always find some Republicans somewhere. And I think in certain areas, you know, especially where Republican, it might be at a state legislative level or a congressional level, you know, in a certain area where they have a relationship with the unions, you sometimes find that kind of stuff where a Republican will be pro-union in a certain area, maybe just because they realized they needed to do that to get elected and stay in power. But broadly speaking, I think you're going to hear them be pretty silent. Just like, again, with UPS, you kind of just didn't really, there were a lot of Democrats and beyond just the progressives who were, you know, fairly vocal, or at least one time were vocal or did something symbolic to support, but you're just not seeing it. And this is part of the problem. I mean, ultimately, the contradiction at the heart of it that people, I mean, such as DeSantis, I mean, he doesn't really give a shit, but even maybe some more sincere people like American Compass folks at the think tank who are trying to think about this thing, ultimately, they're not able to get past the contradiction of like, how are you going to make a Republican Party do things when the donor class that props up this party won't let it happen. And everything that this party stands for is against what, you know, a pro-labor agenda would be for. How are you going to deal with that contradiction? And don't get me wrong, that contradiction exists within the Democrats, of course, you know, so I'm not denying that. But with the Republican Party, it's just so overtly blatant. And I haven't heard a good argument yet of how you're going to actually get these things accomplished. You know, J.D. Vance is talking about, yeah, we should punish corporations that ship jobs overseas or tax them extra. Or, you know, Orrin Cass talks about we need to, like, totally, the government needs to just take over our manufacturing to reshore it away from China. And it's like, well, how are you going to get that kind of intervention on the side of workers in a party like this where, you know, it's just overtly a pro-business Chamber of Commerce party? You know, and if Trump's, you know, first term was any indication, you know, nothing is going to change. And if anything, it's just going to be the same old stuff.
Toussaint, did you want to add something?
One of the things I like that you pointed out in your article was how to bring back manufacturing in the United States, that would be an act of big government. That would pretty much be like a new deal. So I thought that was an excellent point. Do you have anything else you'd like to share along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and yeah, even something smaller, like let's tax a corporation that's gonna ship jobs away. I mean, again, for a party that's at its fundamental heart is about the government not intervening to mess with markets in any way or mess with corporations. How do you envision that actually happening? And you know, you can think about a similar thing the way it's talked about with immigration. You know, ultimately these corporations clearly are making a choice that they would rather use a kind of, you know, lower wage immigrant labor. So what are you going to do to go after those companies to make them stop doing that? You know, this would be a form of intervention that would be pretty huge. And yeah, the idea that, you know, we're going to like somehow get companies to not ship to China and we're going to force them to manufacture here, or the government's going to do it itself. I mean, you're talking about the New Deal or more. And it's just very clear the appetite is not there. And a really revealing thing, you know, there's an interview that J.D. Vance does with Orrin Cass, who's the director of American Compass. And he's talking about, you know, what we got to do. The government's got to intervene to get China, you know, to take on China and get jobs back in the United States. And then the very next sentence he said, but to be clear, I don't want a bigger government. I want a smaller government. Well, it's like, okay, how are those two things going to be accomplished at the same time? So yeah, there's just a fundamental contradiction there.
But what if that's the new pivot to the new right? You know, we don't know who's going to run for president. You know, everybody kind of thinks Trump because, you know, we're still looking at this as a popularity contest. Right. And, you know, what if there is someone that comes up speaking that kind of New Deal-ish rhetoric and kind of eliminates from the verbiage that, you know, all of your problems are big government, which you heard in Clinton and of course Reagan first. What if they do come? What if someone like DeSantis comes in and tries to be the middleman and negotiate with Hollywood and ends that strike? As silly as it sounds, I mean, that's really all they would probably have to do to have,
right,
you know, America by the short and curlies.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily, the Hollywood strike thing, I don't necessarily see that. But I think you're right, because I think this is going to be the trend. Republicans are going to talk a decent game on pro-working class politics. And the danger is, if there is not another candidate on the left countering them, and again, I'm going to go back to 2016, you had Trump speaking to the issues and Hillary not. That's going to be the danger. So in a way, they don't have to really do anything about these problems. But if they can speak about it better than the Democrats are, that's going to be enough to win elections. So I think this is kind of here to stay. These Republican candidates doing this virtue signaling. And again, they're kind of being, they're doing this selective thing of like choosing which corporations they have an issue with and why. But it still gives you the overall impression that they're fighting corporate power. I mean, another trend you kind of notice of a lot of them, they really have this thing about tech companies and social media companies. And it's kind of interwoven with their hatred of these companies because they think it's, you know, suppressing the free speech of the far right or tinted with a liberal bias. So that's kind of their in to attacking a corporation, but it's not really about like the workers there or workers generally. But I think this is going to kind of be the new norm on the right, is like signaling anti-corporate things. And, you know, when you read, if you go DeSantis website, which unfortunately I had to do to write this article, I also had to watch his speech of it. He's a horrible speaker, just like no charisma. But anyway, if you watch the speech, and I think especially if you read the platform, it's called Declaration of Economic Independence. It's just amazing how many lines are in there that if this was on a leftist candidate's page, you would agree with. I mean, he literally says, this is socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for small business owners and taxpayers. You know, he talks about the rich are getting bailed out while working people suffer. I mean, all this stuff is like peppered throughout. Because I think they realize, well, this could work. You know, Trump showed that it worked. This could work for us.
And is that rhetoric that's going to, you know, also hit? Because when we say small business owners or petty bourgeois, right? We don't often think about gig workers, because I think we see them as employees. But the reality is many of them, that's why they voted, not in their best interest, see themselves as small businesses, despite the platform that they're kind of married to. Do they eat this up as well? Because they see, of course, corporations coming up fat kind of on their backs. And this is a very large part of the working class, is gig workers that we don't like to talk about for whatever reason. Toussaint had a good take on that. You want to say what you said about that, Toussaint? I don't want to steal your shine.
About gig workers?
Mm-hmm. Why we don't talk about them?
Oh, I don't know. It's just they're funny to classify. Why? Oh,
you forgot?
Yeah.
You said the left doesn't like to talk about them because of Proposition 22 in California.
Yeah, they were hoodwinked and bamboozled. But
in general, yeah, they just kind of stay quiet about it.
I mean, that would be the same position for any of the voters that believe this right-wing populism rhetoric. They would have to be hoodwinked and bamboozled for that to work.
I mean, we saw it work. We've seen it work. So I don't know. I may not be as dismissive as many that probably watch shows like this. Again, because I saw what happened with, you know, the confusion of Proposition 22.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people not kind of understanding where they sat in the grand scheme of things. And they wanted the freedom. And it was the idea that you are your own business that really was a prevailing message. And threatening that, even as precarious as it was something that no one was willing to give up.
And some of this too, I'm kind of just speculating a little bit. It might have to come down to, I mean, enough people for a long enough of time experiencing that it's not going to work out for them to maybe spur a change. Mm-hmm. I mean, but there's a lot of issues because of the way these gig workers are not classified as employees, which then deals with labor law, and they're not able to be organized in the traditional way. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's all kinds of challenges there that no one really has figured out yet.
I mean, that was one of the before Proposition 22 even came down, one of the compromises of Assembly Bill 5 was that they couldn't unionize.
Right.
And even that wasn't enough.
Same thing with the Amazon drivers. Oof. Amazon warehouse workers are employees and can be organized, and that's going to be a big fight, I mean, among Teamsters and other, but the drivers are not. Now, there is an interesting case. The Teamsters did get an election in California of Amazon drivers, and they won, and of course it's being challenged, and I think they're trying to use that as a springboard to challenge this misclassification of drivers. But it's just a huge issue in our economy and our labor law, is this misclassification of workers in this so-called gig economy. Because by law, they can't be in a union. So then what do you do exactly?
Pascal.
Paul, I wanted to ask you an interesting question that you brought up in your article about why DeSantis, or the fact that DeSantis is not doing well with working class voters and his fight the woke shtick is really only appealing to like college educated Republicans, and the working class in this party are not buying that as a motivator. What strikes me as strange is that why is that strategy still being saturated by Republicans throughout the southern states as a means to gin up popularity? And why has it been so successful in terms of getting it passed if it's not popular?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't think I have a full answer to that, but I think it's, it's a way of framing a class issue as a cultural one. And it's like, I think it's kind of like, well, if you can't win on your actual economic issues, you could at least stick it to the liberal snobs in some way, or, you know, fight back in some way against woke stuff that's annoying and doesn't seem to connect with your life. So I think, in some cases, they're able to successfully just misdirect this class anger to make it be about wokeness. And even if it's stuff that is genuinely annoying shit that probably a lot of working people don't like. And again, it's like, well, at least they're offering me that. No one else is offering me anything else. But I do think there's a limit, which is we're seeing here. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, Trump has made comments on this recently in speeches saying, you know, oh, everyone's using woke now. I don't even know what it means. It's lost its meaning. You know, that's his thing. And I think he's right. And he was, I think, more intelligent about how he used that. And I always used to tell people, like, during the, especially the 2016 campaign, it's like, you should actually watch a full Trump rally from start to finish. And you're going to be surprised, because if it was a pie chart, the slice that was, like, dumb racism and attacking wokeness was actually much smaller than you would have thought. And there was a lot more about economics. And I think he had a better way of balancing attacking wokeness, but also talking about other issues. But as we're seeing with DeSantis, there's a limit. You know, I think he's gone too far in like kind of a rabbit hole on this stuff that probably most people aren't even thinking about or are aware of. But I think they're able to latch on to some stuff that feels, I think, to people like the left overreach with some of this woke stuff. And they're able to frame that as a class issue instead of real economic issue.
I know a lot of people like to say that about Trump, that he had more to say about, you know, kind of bread and butter economic issues, but the news bites were more of the crazy racist stuff. And that's really what's important, right? What's clippable? How many people, even if you're a supporter, actually watch the whole rally? How many people actually watch Bernie Sanders rallies? Like, let's just be honest. You know, people are watching the clips.
Right.
And that's, you know, why we're still talking about him now. We're talking about him because he's clickbait. But so is DeSantis, maybe for the wrong reasons. And there was a time where Joe Biden was polling like, and none of us thought he was going to be president. We had Bronco on the show a few weeks ago. He wrote a book about the end of an era, and that era is in office. So,
yeah.
What is,
I mean, there is partly an individual charisma. And I will say about Biden, he does have a certain kind of charisma. Maybe I'm crazy for saying this. I think.
Let me tell you something. Mm-hmm. Shock people, because I don't like Democrats, and people know that. I don't like either
party. Shock the world, Pascal. Shock the world.
I'm going to tell you something.
Joe Biden's a frat brother.
But no, he's not. But before 2016, go back and watch the debate between Joe Biden in 2012 and the guy who was the vice presidential candidate from, what was the name, from Wisconsin, who was the right-wing wonder boy that they all were like.
Oh, the one that tried to get rid of the teachers union?
Yeah, what was his name?
Yeah. Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan.
Yeah.
Watch the debate between Joe Biden and Paul Ryan. Biden destroys him.
Yep.
He destroys him because Biden has that old school Irish Northeastern kind of, you know, kind of like throw a jab at him, you know, boisterous rhetoric. He was, I'm not going to say he was a great public speaker, but, or eloquent, but he was not bland in his communication style by any stretch of the imagination. He was very engaging. So, I'm not going to say I'm going to speculate on his mental condition, but I think that there's something has happened in 2016 that has taken him off his highest performance. But if you look at Biden's former speeches and political performances, he was not like,
he was sharp.
He was kind of sharp.
Well, you know, maybe politics is like boxing, and these people don't have a long shelf life because Joe Biden is punch drunk on the podium at this point, Jack. And he might have been, you know, towards the end of his career, you know, but now he's like the latter years Muhammad Ali, if that's, you know.
Oh, yeah, no, he's
a boxer.
I don't, listen, man, I'm not.
Let's just hope Trump is not Larry Holmes.
Listen, and I'm going to be fair here.
Just hope.
Trump is very entertaining, man.
Right.
Trump is very entertaining. Like, Trump says some, he comes back with some funny little jabs.
Right. He has a certain banter. And this is the thing, I mean, when we're just talking about, like, why is DeSantis failing? I mean, part of it is just the charisma. I mean, again, I watched that speech. I was kind of just, I hadn't watched DeSantis, like, for a long period of time because I'm trying to maintain a happy life. but I was kind of shocked at how, it's just like, this is just bad, you know, and clearly Trump would destroy him.
I just don't think Trump is funny.
Trump can be funny if he's arguing with a politician you don't like. I despise the Clintons, and I despise Hillary Clinton. And when he said lock her up, I was like, I love it. I was just, this is crazy.
You know what? Donald Trump is funny to people that think like, remember like Bob Saget on that video show was funny? Like those are people that are Trump jokes. It's not funny. It's just not funny.
I think he says some funny stuff.
Like,
he's a lounge comedian.
He is a lounge comedian.
Take his wife, please. It's but not,
I think,
funny.
You know, to try and bring this back, I mean, what is exciting about this moment in labor when you look at UPS? And I mean, we haven't even, I won't go into a rabbit hole of the details of the agreement, but, and workers are voting on the deal at UPS. The voting will end on August 22nd. So we'll see how the vote goes. But I mean, I think in many objective ways, you could say this is the best agreement won at UPS, maybe ever, if not since the 1990s. So, you know, a huge step forward. We have the United Auto Workers coming up, the Writers and Actors Guild. You know, I mean, what is, I think, encouraging about all this stuff is it's outside the electoral realm. And of course, the electoral realm interacts with it and it has an impact on elections. But that is kind of what, to me, is nice about this moment, is it's not about the horse race, but there is something happening in labor. We don't know where this is all going to go, but there are some encouraging signs. And I think one thing that's really important right now, I think I sent Jason the message about this a few weeks ago, is it's starting to happen in among industrial workers and among some of the largest existing unions, which I think has to happen. You know, with the Starbucks stuff, I think one thing to keep in mind, and I'm saying this as someone, I am you know, very happy about the Starbucks organizing. I've gone to a lot of events in Philadelphia, but one sobering fact to keep in mind, you could add up all the Starbucks workers who have organized in the country so far. And it's like a lot, hundreds of stores so far. You could add them all up. It would not be as many workers as one single big UPS facility or one single Amazon facility, which is just to say, you know, to keep in mind the scale. We haven't reached a big enough scale yet. And part of getting there is this happening among the big industrial unions. So that's kind of what's exciting about now. These unions are kind of getting reformed from within, made more militant, made more democratic, and they're using that energy to win great contracts, you know, to fight back concessions, to win new gains. So that's the kind of stuff we have to see happening. And it's outside the electoral game, which is refreshing.
Unions have reached their highest popularity amongst American citizens in over 50 years.
Right. And this, and that all plays a point in, it makes a difference in these fights. Like I can tell you, I mean, if there was a strike at UPS, I think the public would have been on the workers' side, partly because, I mean, there was a year-long contract campaign that was deliberately cultivating public support. So, you know, it makes a difference in these fights, like where the public stands. And that's what politicians look at. You know, in 1997, that was the last UPS strike. And, you know, the business world was pushing Clinton to intervene with an injunction, and he didn't. And probably the main reason was the polls were showing almost 70% of Americans supported the workers. The support is high. It hasn't translated into this exponential growth and density yet, but we're seeing some encouraging things happen. But it's just helpful to keep in mind, like, when we talk about Starbucks, we're still talking about a very small scale, ultimately, in the grand scheme of things.
When are we going to see people talk about unionizing FedEx?
Yeah, I mean, that has been a longstanding goal. I mean, even back in the 90s, that's what the Teamsters were talking about. And that's a longstanding goal.
Why is FedEx resistant?
It's a very reactionary company, headquarters in Memphis, that has very, very free market politics.
I mean, you can say that about Amazon.
Yeah. And I mean, right now, I think the bigger idea in people's head is Amazon. I mean, I don't know exactly how that's going to happen, but I mean, the Teamsters are already there. We, of course, had the breakthrough with the independent union, the Amazon labor union. But yeah, I mean, these are the big tasks before us. I mean, if anyone had the answer of exactly how, because you can't organize Amazon plant by plant. You just can't. There has to be kind of this wave. And that's also how it's happened historically in labor. It's sort of, you have these waves, but it's hard to really predict when or how that will happen exactly. But at somewhere like Amazon, you can't go one by one. I mean, you'll just never get there. So it's a big challenge.
I mean, go ahead. Do something, please.
I have a question. I ran into somebody today who works in the film industry, and I asked, you know, how's it going? And she's like, it's great. I've been working at a cafe. I'm like, oh.
Filming in the cafe? Or?
Not quite. Not quite.
Cafe only fans?
16 hours a day just at the cafe.
Naked lattes?
Not quite.
What's she being? Was that sarcasm?
No, she's sincere. Okay. She is working at a cafe now because she can't even afford to be on the picket line. She's got to get that rent paid. Yeah. So how does the average person support the union and unionization? How do we support these people if we
can't afford to?
So are you nigga?
Are you saying, you're saying if you are a worker on strike or a worker trying to unionize?
If you're just a regular person, how do you support someone on strike?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would definitely, I know definitely that the Writers Guild or Actors Guild has a strike fund. I would definitely donate to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think showing up, the public showing up to picket lines means a lot. I mean, you might want to try to come with a group. It might be a little awkward, but, you know, it means a lot because people are out there basically all day, and especially as the days and weeks go on, mm-hmm. having people from the public show up can mean a lot. But I think financially, I mean, by the time there's an actual strike, unions will have a strike fund. And I'm sure if you Google like the Actors Guild or whatever, I think giving to that is probably the best way financially.
They like pizza too, right?
Yeah, bring food to the picket lines. You know.
So you are confident that this UPS victory is transformative?
Yes. I mean, to what level, I don't know. I mean, I can't sit here and say for sure this UPS victory is going to lead to now Amazon being organized and all this stuff. But I mean, at least for the workers at UPS first, yes. I mean, there are some huge gains in there. I mean, I can run through some quickly. I mean, one of the big ones was, you know, in 2018, and I'll give a quick history lesson, from the late 90s until 2018, Jimmy Hoffa Jr. was president of the Teamsters, the son of Jimmy Hoffa. And unlike Hoffa Sr., you know, Hoffa Sr. came out of the union, at least. He had his issues, but he was an organizer and he came up through the ranks that way. And they won some very strong contracts, you know, at one point. But his son was like a corporate lawyer that, like, switched over to the union. So, you know, there was all these concessions. In 2018 contract, two-tier wage scale was introduced. So that's when workers hired after a certain point are paid less than the workers who have been there. And obviously this creates division. It's not fair. It's horrible. And a majority of Teamsters in 2018 voted to reject that contract. And the union said, no, we're just going to shove it down your face anyway. So that kind of reignited a reform movement that got him out of power in 2021. And we have new leadership now at the top. So anyway, that all set the stage for this fight. So one of the big things that was won was getting rid of two-tier. So that's now gone. And, you know, once two-tier is in contracts, they're very hard to get rid of. So that was a big achievement. United Auto Workers, that's something they're going to be focused on, this contract. There's been two-tier in the auto plants for a long time. And it's really the worst thing that could happen to a union because of the division. So that was addressed. Part-timer wages. You know, I think the last time I was on the show with Richard Hooker, we talked about this. The majority of UPS workers are part-timers mm-hmm. in the warehouse, you know, sorting packages, loading them onto trucks, and getting paid pretty badly. It's a little bit complicated, the part-time wage scale, but some of them are seeing as big as a $10 an hour bump wages during this contract. Some of them are going from like 16 an hour to over 25 an hour by the end of this contract. So that's a huge win for the part-timers who have been just so underpaid for a long time. Air conditioning in the trucks, this is something that made the news, believe it or not. Passenger cars did not have air conditioning. You know, a lot of workers have died from heat stroke. So there's now a plan and commitment to get air conditioning into the trucks. You know, not them not being able to use the surveillance cameras in the trucks. And also, I mean, a huge wage increase. You know, now package car drivers, not the part-timers, package car drivers, when they reach top rate, they're going to be earning over $100,000 a year. Which is, should be the standard. I mean, this should be, you know, you're working a job, you should be paid to the point where you're living a decent life and getting taken care of your family. For workers in the South, over 40,000 workers, they got a bump of $1,000 more per month in their pension now. I mean, that's huge. So we're talking over $12,000 more a year when they're retiring. So I could keep going, but I mean, there's a lot of huge things, a lot of concessions that were undone from the past and new wins. Not every single thing was won. I mean, it's going to be rare to find a contract that you just win outright 100%. So there's definitely things in there, not perfect. Not everything was addressed. And like I said, workers are going to vote on it. And we'll see the results of that. So I think it was definitely transformative for within this union. And I think the way it was done as well, I mean, this campaign was night and day from 2018. And now, this time, workers were actually prepared to strike. I mean, a lot of people might have saw the news throughout July. There was practice picketing in cities across the country, getting ready to strike. Members were involved in a way they were not before. So this all came about because workers were united and had a real strike threat. So I think just that transforms the union. And, you know, Amazon workers are paying attention. I mean, in Philadelphia, just to give an example, I mean, the workers here are now going to automatically go up to 25 an hour whenever the contract's ratified. And Amazon workers who are making 20 are looking at that and are talking about that. And they can use that as an example of why we need a union. So, you know, it remains to be seen how transformative. But even the United Auto Workers, I think, are taking inspiration from this, especially when it comes to getting rid of two-tier. Because, you know, teams have showed this could be done. So, yeah, we'll see how far this goes. But I think this is definitely a big step forward for labor.
Well, I mean, there's been several strikes. You know, Oakland Unified School District went on strike earlier this year and got their demands met. They were, you know, beyond just better wages and classroom conditions. They had some quality of life demands. UPS. We've yet to see what's going to happen with Hollywood. I don't actually.
And there's a bunch of like LA, there's like
hotel worker right strike now. Is massive. Yeah. That is massive. Yeah. Because you're kind of talking about an unskilled sector. And a lot of these Republicans do speak to the more quote unquote skilled sector or the trades, maybe more so right. than they do the unskilled sector, because I don't think they really put value in those positions.
Right. And actually, can I say one thing? Because you mentioned it, just something I covered in the article, because you mentioned hotels. You know, another thing the right is focused on is when it comes to immigration. You know, one solution American Compass put out there was like, well, we should be incentivizing immigration of higher skilled workers, higher wage workers who will drive up wages. But, you know, what they're, again, they're really misplacing the target or the enemy here. Because think about, I mean, all the industries in this country that do not have heavy immigrant labor, or all the regions as well, that are still low wage. I mean, there's no guarantee. The biggest guarantee would be having a union. And then you look at an industry like hospitality and hotels, mainly through the union Unite Here, which is a national union, you know, dealing with, in many cases, a mostly immigrant workforce, and they've been able to substantially raise wages. So, you know, the fact of there being immigrant workers is not going to be the determining factor of whether the wages of, you know, U.S. citizens are going to be high. But that's just another example of they can skirt the main issue to talk about something on the side. But they're missing the real solution.
We have a super chat for you. Mm-hmm. What other union has the leverage UPS had over both the employer and Biden? None by my count.
The teachers union in West Virginia. I mean, they shut down that state pretty much. You never talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think any union, if they get to a point, if they get all the workers in the state, but yeah, I mean, I think UPS just its position in the economy. 5% of the country's GDP is moved by UPS every day. So obviously a strike, you know, would really do damage to the economy. And again, I think that's part of, you know, there are some people, I think, I don't think we should fetishize strikes on the left. You know, I think that, like, yeah, would it have been cool for there to have been a UPS strike? Yes. But the bigger point is there was a credible strike threat. The company knew they were willing to do it. And they saw how united they were. And the company said, well, you know what, let me just give them, you know, what they're asking for instead of going through that. So, yeah. Maybe it didn't end in a strike, but it ended with workers showing their collective power and winning and being prepared to strike. So we shouldn't just fetishize strikes too much. I think it's more about the credible strike threat. I mean, if you can win it without going on it, but showing that you can, I think that's still a good step forward.
And on that note, we are coming up on an hour. Feels so good. We started on time, we're ending on time. We're going to go to the champagne room. I think we'll open the phone lines up for a little bit. Is that good with you guys?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I do have some videos for you. Did you see any of them, Toussaint, while you were locked out of your house?
Oh, no, I didn't.
You know, it's still the 50th anniversary of hip hop, and I've still been finding more wonderful hip hop tracks for us to pull from Pascal.
Wow.
It's my new favorite thing. Celebrating hip hop's anniversary with Pascal, who was there at the first ever hip hop party.
And the first Thanksgiving. Sorry, I had to.
Paul, are you going to join us for this rundown, the hip hop? I've been finding contemporary hip hop.
You haven't? I won't be able to contribute much.
Not a fan of the Beastie Boys, Paul?
That's as contemporary as Pascal.
Right, I'm just going to say that's contemporary.
Pascal was there for like the first ever hip hop show. He was at the park. He was the little kid.
He was at the park.
Tapping the lines in the telephone pole.
It did look wrong. I saw.
Pascal also was an original member of New Edition.
Mm. He couldn't get the dances right. His heart belonged to house.
His heart belonged to house.
I was actually going to say, like, the beginning of this show, you really, Jason, you just put his weight out there.
I wish that was my weight, bro.
It's like a football player. You know how they have the universe? Sometimes I'll put all the schools he went to, all 15 universities.
15? Wow.
I didn't go to 15 universities. Don't believe anything these people say. Pure horse crap. I name all
the latest degree was DeVry.
His doctorate. A doctor from DeVry.
University of Phoenix.
He's a doctor.
That reminds me of the best Key and Peele skit with the football player names.
Oh.
And the guy that's like, his name is Harvard University, and he went to DeVry University.
Did you see how many football players actually have the names that they made up in that skit?
No, I'm sure it's...
I'll find it. It's rather hilarious. The link is up for the patrons. If you guys want to call in, let us know what you think about this current labor uprising, right-wing populism. Should we be worried? Do you think Ron DeSantis really has a chance? Will Trump get arrested? Will Trump actually have another term as president? Can Joe Biden do it again? Will Kamala Harris take over as president?
No, she won't.
Wow. Is that Afro pessimism?
Indian pessimism.
Indo-Jamaican pessimism.
I think whatever you just said is racist.
It's Haitian optimism.
Oh, Haitian optimism. That doesn't exist. No. I did find a Haitian rapper.
We have a few.
And this Haitian rapper, I'm going to need you guys to tell me what he's saying, because I don't know what he's saying. I don't know. Maybe it translates in the Haitian customs, is the things he's doing, but I don't think they're words.
In Haitian customs.
Wow. Whatever you people call them.
Whatever you people call it. But I'll need you guys to tell me exactly what's going on in this rhyme. And then again, call in. Let us know what you guys think. And on that note, we are
out.